Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. Concept. Oof. All this love talk. Love, love, love. Such an amazing thing to talk about. In the studio with me, co-hosting today, Stephanie Dombra.
Hi, Armand.
Hi there. Love, such a confusing thing. Such a very confusing thing. Let's talk about marriage. Marriage, the original concept of marriage. Why do you think we even evolved marriage? It was a way to pool the labor of the men and women to enable families to subsist and assure that the children survive to independence. But beyond the basics, the purpose of marriage has shifted constantly. The earliest purpose of marriage was to make strategic alliances with other people to turn strangers into relatives. Not a bad idea, huh? Tony married, you know, my daughter marries Tony next door, the kid next door, and now I become a relative to the person next door to me, and we're related. They'll watch my back, I'll watch theirs. And then our cousins marry somebody, and we become further related. Not a bad idea. Even through the 19th century, the belief prevailed that males and females had different natures and couldn't be expected to understand each other. So marriage was like more an agreement. This is what you do. Here's a man, here's a woman. We put you together, and we're going to make it work. That's the idea of a marriage.
Well, what's interesting, though, is that women and men did not really understand each other, though. So it was hard to imagine back then, before the 18th century even, that people could live together, men and women could live together.
So when you say men and women didn't understand each other, you mean a man did not understand what a woman was different than what a man is?
Yes. I mean, we assume that what is now, in a sense, was in the past and will be in the future. And we really don't have any understanding now of what relationships were like 200 or 300 years ago, other than to read about it and understand it from that perspective. So all this idea of intimacy and talking and getting to know each other, that didn't really exist. So they were like two different kind of people.
But we put you together, put these two people together, and they're going to make it work. That's their job. See, and the idea is you two folks who are making this agreement to live in the same cave, in the same house, have these children under the same religious belief system, you're going to make it work. That's the idea. Make it work. It's like a partnership. It's like a business. Make it work. Now, that was the idea. Only in the 20th century did the idea take hold that men and women should be companions, that they should also be passionate, and that both should get sexual and personal fulfillment from marriage. Because before then, sexual fulfillment did not necessarily mean marriage for the man. For the woman, I think it was kind of restricted. I don't even know if there was a concept of sexual fulfillment for women. I don't even know if that was a concept.
I don't think so.
You know, clearly. So it wasn't.
Even though historically people have been sexual with each other, but in terms of just marriage.
Hara Estroff-Morano is a guest that we've had on the radio. She's with Psychology Today. She writes articles for Psychology Today. She wrote the most fascinating article about marriage and relationships, and we're going to bring it to you today. It's something that you don't usually hear, but probably one of the most important pieces that you could learn about. Because we're still trying to figure it out. Americans value marriage more than people in any other culture, she says. And it holds a central place in our dreams. Over 90% of young adults, aspire to marriage. Although fewer are actually choosing it, many opting instead for cohabitation, but no matter how you count it, Americans have the highest rate of romantic breakup in the world. Andrew Cherlin, professor of sociology and public policy at Johns Hopkins. Marriages are discarded often before the partners know what hit them. You get together, boom, 5 years later, 6 years later, you get a little itch, out the door. By age 35, 10% of American women have lived with three or more husbands or domestic partners. That's shocking, isn't it?
In this day and age, compared to 30 years ago, even 40 years ago, very different now.
My first husband, my second husband, my third husband.
That used to be reserved for all the Hollywood stars.
Yeah, right. It sounded like Hollywood stuff. It did. Children of married parents in America face a higher risk of seeing them break up than children born of unmarried parents in Sweden. But I don't know, we have to talk about Sweden. Sweden's an odd place. You know, there's a movie out that's called The Woman with the Tattoo. It just came out. It's a little S&M kind of movie, but it's a very popular Swedish movie. So The Girl with the Tattoo is the name of it, named after the book, a very popular book called The Girl with the Tattoo. In Swedish, the name of the book is The Man Who Hated Women. That was their translation. So Swedish relationships need to be looked at. But getting back to this idea, we have this idea of a consumer culture and choices. Now, are you part of a consumer generation? Are you a consumer? In consumerism, you have choices. You go to a grocery store. You don't call up and you don't go to the grocery store and see apples, pears, Nabisco, a couple of things. You see hundreds of choices. Thousands of choices. Every corner, even if it's your local Korean store on the corner where the guy's got in his window, every kind of medicine, every kind of, it's jammed in there. You have choice after choice after choice after choice. You could walk in and you have five kinds of butter and seven kinds of milk and all those different beers, choice after choice after choice. That's the way we are in America. Make your choices, make your choices, make your choices. Now, Stephanie, what do you think choice has to do with relationships?
Well, that whole mindset seeps into our private lives in that we look and assume now that we can have an abundance of choices to choose a partner with all the internet dating and people just saying, I'm going to put my list of items. I want him to be funny. I want her to be pretty. I want her to be slim. List your items of what you want in a partner. See if you can find that on your match.com or whatever these kind of devices or websites offer. And it gives you this idea that you can choose and try to find the person that you think is perfect for you.
And many people have been successful at finding mates that way. They found people that worked. And then many other people will tell you, oh, I met people who fit the criteria, but the chemistry wasn't there. So we're saying there's a lot of different factors involved here, but this idea of choice. Now, this idea of choice really is a plague to many people, many cultures, especially many sexual preferences.
Well, because there's an excess, I think, especially if you think even in terms of the gay men in this particular, you know, time of life, with all the choices of easy to hook up and the internet and going out there and meeting men.
And Craigslist and
everything. It's all there, and it serves a great purpose for many people to be able to find things out and learn about things. The internet is, of course, a wonderful kind of avenue for knowledge. But it also gives us so many choices. So we can go out to the street and, you know, see people. We can go on the internet and look on these websites. And so for back to the plight, I call it the plight of a gay man, where he has so many choices and looks for so many men that later on after they have these experiences, some men, I don't ever want to generalize, but some men will have an abundance of experiences with other men, and then they want to really partner up and have a long-term relationship. And they're desensitized, I call it. They have kind of gotten to such a point where no one can ever really kind of stick in there and have a long-term relationship, because everybody's kind of numbed out by their experiences of hundreds of thousands of sexual encounters.
Well, even if you don't have that many, you get numbed out by this idea of beauty, you know, of physical beauty. So you're working out in the gym, so you've got muscles, and age is such anathema to many gay men who have been trading on their beauty.
Well, that's the other issue of they're going after perfection. The perfect body.
And where do we get this idea of perfection?
Well, I think it's partly this idea that is built in. We want beauty. We want, again, a perfect partner. And that perfect partner has to look a certain way. And if they don't match that criteria, then we're always going to be disappointed.
The idea that there is perfection has been part of the plague of the exercise world and the holistic health world. You can have perfect health. You can have perfect everything. You can have a perfect body. You can get rid of all of your body fat. You could, and there's this perfect, perfect, perfect you strive for. And you go to the gym and you do your curls and you look at your arm building and you say, perfect. And you strut your muscles and you say, perfect. And you look at your rump and you say, perfect. And you're looking for this perfect sense, perfect self, this perfect being. And when somebody else sees it, they go, wonderful, you're perfect. But then when they see a flaw, they're so used to perfection that they want out. They have to run away. They've got to find another perfect person. Does he talk well? Is he successful? Does he have money? Does he have energy? Does he have curiosity? Is he a growing person? These are the questions that we put into our criteria of who are we going to choose. This is part of our culture. Our culture has sold you that there is perfection available, so keep looking. Because if not, there'd only be three products. You see, that's why we said, I got an email the other day from someone who said, you know, Armand, you should do a show about hair. And I said, and it said, about shampoo. And I said, what about shampoo? He said, well, shampoo has the illusion that if you use it, it's going to wash your hair and it's going to penetrate your hair and do better for your hair. But shampoo is soap and it really just wipes your hair down. It takes everything out of it. And then at the end of it, he said, but we just invented a new shampoo that doesn't do that. You see? So here we have this new thing. This new thing is going to come on and create a new other thing that's going to be perfect. Armand DeMille here with you with The Positive Mind. Perfection. You sit with your mate. You and your mate are asking each other, what are we doing here? You know, what are we doing here? You know, and you sometimes you try to get caught up in the world. But relationships are very, very difficult. And part of what's difficult is trying to see what's real and what's not real. Options, the heightened focus on options, leads to a heightened sensitivity to people. You know, they become, give me more choices, more choices, more choices. And now comes this sense of entitlement. Let's talk about that.
Well, what also happens is there's this expectation that instead of a partnership, marriage becomes a way to get pleasure from another person. In other words, it's about me. And there was a period, I don't know if we're still in it, Armand, but there was the me generation and this idea that I'm going to get my needs met from this relationship. This person, when I get married, is supposed to take care of my emotional well-being. When I want to talk, I want that person to listen to me. And all those expectations that you bring into a relationship can really set up very, very disappointing times, and sometimes even, obviously, the end of a relationship if you feel like your needs aren't getting met.
Now, I'm not saying that it's wrong to be in the me generation. Maybe that's right. But like Stephanie says, there are a lot of inherent definitions. Our mindset has further shifted over the past few decades. Today, the minute one partner is faced with dissatisfaction, feeling stressed out or neglected, having a partner who isn't overly expressive or who works too hard or doesn't initiate sex very often, then the communal ideal we bring to a relationship is jettisoned and an individualistic mentality asserts itself. We revert to that stingier self that's been programmed into us by the consumer culture, which has only become increasingly pervasive. Psychologically, the goal of life becomes my happiness. My happiness. I am not happy. That's the question. The constant appraisal of your personal life to improve happiness creates a heightened sensitivity to problems that arise in intimate relationships. What has happy got to do with it? Why do you have to make me happy? I am not happy in this relationship. Therefore, you have to make me happy.
Well, it's interesting to think about how this evolved because, I don't think the concept of people going into marriage 100 years ago that they were thinking, this is going to make me happy, you know, again, that partnership. And I don't think people want to go backwards and say, let's have all these traditional roles and that we shouldn't have equal kind of power or position in a relationship. But this idea that we're going to go in there and say, this is what's going to finally make me happy, is an illusion. And I think if people understand it when they go in and things get tough, then you don't run away. A really good example that Hara wrote about in this article was actually about Michelle Obama and Barack. They actually wrote a book about their marriage. And Michelle gave this example that years ago when she was the primary breadwinner and she was doing all the work with the children and raising the kids and Barack had to go off as a state senator and he was hardly home, she was furious and she was nagging at him that she needed his help. And he said, why is she always nagging me, literally? And she finally realized she kept expecting that he was going to help her, be there to listen to her. And she realized, you know, I need help, but not necessarily from him. And when she made that shift away from thinking it had to come from him, then things changed for them. And I think a lot of people fight over that expectation that as soon as we have these kids and as soon as we set this up, it all has to be done together. And yes, you have to figure this out when you're going to run a household, if you're going to buy a home and have kids. You better figure out how to do this in addition to try and have a relationship and be intimate and have fun together. There's a lot that goes into being in a relationship in this day and age.
Where does the sense of entitlement come into this, Stephanie?
Well, maybe years over the course of time, and I believe this strongly, that women had to fight for rights. And that was important, and it was necessary in the 60s and 70s to say, hey, wait a minute, we have to get things too. So that made total sense for many people, including many men too. But something happened in the last 30 years or so that probably made us focus, whether it was psychology, psychotherapy, you know, self-help books, all these messages that we got were, you're entitled now. You deserve to build up your self-esteem. All these messages, I think, came at us over the last several decades to say, what about me? And I don't know if it's a pendulum, but right now, probably from what Hara is writing about and what we think about, Armand, and other people on this listener audience thinks about, what are we doing? If you're conscious of these things, you can really try to question it. So I think that's we're here now to try to understand why are so many people unhappy in marriage, and yet we have more and more choices. So excess choice makes you feel worse on some level.
It's part of that free market value. It's this thing about I am entitled. I'm entitled to better. I'm entitled to better. When I think about some of the New Age things that get quoted all over the place, you know, the message and I am entitled to the best. Well, we're growing a narcissistic culture. In a narcissistic culture, you think of terms of I and how my shell and my being is entitled, but what makes you entitled? What makes you entitled to love? Entitled. You can't find a perfect person. You have to be a perfect person. You can't find a mate.
I wouldn't even use that word perfect.
I won't use person ever.
Person?
You have to be a person. You have to be a perfect raven.
Raven. Oh, do you want me to talk about the raven?
Tell me about the ravens.
I was watching a show on nature about ravens. And it's a beautiful, fascinating, intelligent bird, Armand. And, this is part of the problem. In our animal kingdom, there are animals that mate for life and animals that are not monogamous. So we always have this conflicting problem. Where do we fit as humans? But ravens live 40 years and they mate for life. So that just fascinated me that it could live that long. It's intelligent. It's very, very capable of surviving all sorts of harsh elements. And it mates for life.
40-year-old raven?
Yes.
Jesus. Raven-haired beauties. Raven.
I never heard of that term.
Raven hair for black hair.
I guess, yes. And they are one of the few animals that have pupils like us. So they really look at you, and you feel that they really are processing things, and they're observing. Interesting bird.
Hmm.
And I love birds.
And they quote the raven, nevermore. Nevermore. But let's talk about this. I mean, signing up for life. If you have a marriage, you're in a relationship, my friend, you got a rocky road. Part of the reason that Stephanie Dahmer talks about this so easily is because that's what she does. She talks to people who come in with these expectations, perfectionism, the idea of perfectionism. It's one of the things. And as you listen to people, you hear them. Entitlement becomes another big issue. The whole concept of entitlement is as I've got to have the best, I've got to have the perfect, and choices. These are issues that we deal with all the time. The expectations trap is perfection, please. Please make it perfect. If it's unhappy, please make it perfect. If they're unhappy with you, well, if perfection is what you expect, you'll always be disappointed. We become picky and unhappy. I know someone who in a marriage was saying, all I want to do, well, first she said, I want to live with you, right? And he said, okay. And then, he told Stu two stories. He told one story about the woman who wanted to live with him 2 days a week. She said, I have to travel in town 2 days a week. I want to live with you. He said, okay. Then she said, I want to make it 3 days. And then over time, she said 4 days, 5 days. And it was up to 6 days. And she said, I want to live with you 6 days a week. And he realized, he said, and then I realized that seven would not be enough. And so he broke the relationship. Because he's right. When you get to, not that he's right, but you get to a point where somebody is asking you to do something that doesn't feel right to you, and you do it over and over and over again, thinking this is going to settle the issue. What's going to make you happy? Most men who leave marriages in their midlife leave marriages with the express purpose of not being able to satisfy their wives. This is according to a recent book written by a friend of mine, Shoshana. And she said, you know, so in doing the interview, the men turned around and said, I couldn't make her happy. I couldn't make her happy. She wanted a car. I got her a car. She didn't get happy. She said, if I have a house, if I have children, if I have grandchildren. But no matter what he did, he couldn't make it happy, and he believed that was his job.
And that's the problem, Armand. We assume that the other person is supposed to provide that for us, and we blame. And one key thing that is in this article and is a firm belief of mine is we really have to take responsibility for our own well-being. I mean, we share, we do things in relationships that bring us joy, but this idea that it's your fault. You talk about this all the time, the you, and it's a key part of why people get disappointed in relationships. And the point is, if you're looking for the right partner, as you said, you have to be the partner, not look for the right partner. You have to be the right person, which means you have to take responsibility for yourself.
Well, that's a funny word, responsibility.
Yes.
Let's change it.
Okay.
Let's change it. Let's say you have to not put the relationship on the responsibility on somebody else. And you have to acknowledge your own desires. It's not being responsible. You don't have to. You know, they used to talk about owning feelings. You should own your feelings. Hey, you could go rent them. You know what I mean? Try it out for size. But if you want to be satisfied in a relationship with somebody else, you have to find that satisfaction. If you need to be happy, that person's not going to make you happy. You got to get happy, whether you got to take Prozac, go to therapy, or jump in cold baths. Like I heard somebody did 30 years ago, the doctor would prescribe that people should jump into ice pools to relieve their depression, and it worked. They'd jump in, would do the whole thing to their chemistry, and it would make them better. But whatever you've got to do to make yourself better, make yourself better. And then have a mate. And try to share with that mate how that mate makes themselves better. Because for as long as we are you-you-ing, which is pointing the finger and saying you are responsible, it's just not going to work. Because nobody can make you happy. They could please you. Now, there is a question about pleasure. Is a mate's purpose to give you pleasure? A lot of people believe that what I'm supposed to get from my mate is pleasure. A lot of men keep girlfriends for as long as they give them pleasure. They keep wives as long as they give them pleasure. It's another arrangement. I'm not going to sit here and say that that's a terrible arrangement. Some people live with that and enjoy it. There are some people who love to give pleasure. I just want to make you happy. And they spend their whole lives that way. In the Enneagram, these are the twos. And they do it, and they do it all the time. And there are men who like to receive it, or the reverse of that, women and women. Any of that. So pleasure is another principle. That it is something that you do to give me. Now, in most of the marriages, when that issue comes up, it's a very bogus issue. Can you give me pleasure so much so that I feel at peace? Or do you just make me calm for a moment?
Well, I think it's inherent that if you're in a relationship and it's balanced, you're going to receive pleasure from the other person. And it's a natural kind of expression of love to say, I'd like to do this for you. I'd like to make this meal for you. I'd like to take the garbage out for you. Instead of all that kind of thing of nagging, you know, that many times people will talk about. But, you know, if there's kind of a flow and a balance in a relationship, the pleasure kind of takes care of itself, you know, instead of the demanding.
It's a different kind of pleasure.
Yeah.
It's a different kind of pleasure. It's the pleasure that comes from generosity and caring. I want to do for you. Let me get that for you. Let me get it for you, you know, a nice thing to do. We're not saying you should not do this. You want to give pleasure to your partner, you give them pleasure. You do it as a natural thing, not as a responsibility. If it's the deal that it should be responsible, you're in trouble, because then that person always has something to hold back. Therefore, every time you want to have something, or any time they disagree with you, they have this weapon. I hold your pleasure in my hands, and if you're not nice to me, I won't give it to you. Tough stuff, and so many men talk about being...
I see that, too. I hear it all the time. Yep.
And it says sex is not available, right? You give sex as the jewel. You hold my sex and my pleasure in your hands, and if I don't behave right, I'm not going to get it. That's the way a lot of people feel. Hey, this is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. We're going to have to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to continue with this. Quite a story, a very brief excursion into music, and then we'll continue. We'll be right back.
Only two things scare me, and one is nuclear war.
What's the other one?
Excuse me?
What's the other thing that scares you?
Hi, this is Jamie.
Hi, this is Sarah from Brand Van 3000, and you're listening to WBAI
99.5
FM. New York.
TalkBack is your gathering place for the free and fair exchange of information and ideas, heard here Monday through Thursday from 3 until 5 in the afternoon. I'm Hugh Hamilton. Join me as we explore the issues and events making news across the nation and around the world with expert guests, insightful analysis, and, of course, your comments, questions, and observations. That's TalkBack right here on WBAI New York.
Bud Shank, accentuate the positive. Hey, listen, friends, this is Armand DeMille with you with the positive mind. Now, ultimately, the heightened sensitivity to relationship problems that follows from constantly appraising our happiness encourages couples to turn disappointment into tragedy. Disappointment. Where do we get this idea about disappointment? The disappointment is you didn't come across. Right? I know a guy who had a relationship. He had a wonderful relationship with a person, but he was all tangled up in a business thing. And he was so tangled up in his business that he couldn't get out of it. When he finally got out of it, he turned to his girlfriend and he said, "Oh, now be there for me." And she said, wait a minute. I wasn't there for you before in this kind of way. I can't be 100% now. I have other things that I do. And he said, "But I'd freed myself up for you." No, he didn't. He freed himself up for him. And turning to her and expecting her to provide him with everything that he was missing, all through that other involvement, very interesting. Happens a lot with married men who leave, or married women who leave their relationships and then turn to their partners. Their partners say, "That's not what I was here for. I wasn't expecting the whole load to be put on my doorstep. And I hate disappointing you." And that's where the idea comes. You start getting the feeling that you're disappointing your partner. And somehow we have to get rid of that concept. Because from the partner's point of view, they feel disappointed. From the other person's point of view, they feel like they're disappointing you. But the whole thing is bogus.
Well, I think that happens particularly now with people who have outside affairs, Armand. That feels like a tragedy, and it's understandable, but they're going to go outside and have a relationship and then come back and say, "Wait a minute, you think I'm going to stay with you now because you've done this act of betrayal?" It makes it really complicated for people to realize that it's not about the outside affair, it's about what's going on in your relationship. There was inherent problems there in the first place. So it's so easy, again, to say, "Well, you disappointed me when you went out there and you didn't give me what I needed and you had to go out there and find it in somebody else." Same kind of problem here. Over and over again, it comes out.
Do you think, Stephanie, that this betrayal of somebody stepping out on their partner should be the end of a relationship?
I don't, Armand. I'm going to say that unequivocally. If you can really stick in there and learn from that experience. Relationships are people growing machines. You get to be really adult if you're really going to say, "Wait a minute, I have to understand what I'm doing, why I'm doing it." And if both people want to stay in there, then you can work through an affair without a doubt.
Even if the affair continues.
Then you have to rearrange the kind of whole setup in a way.
But you're saying it is not the disaster that everybody thinks
it
is.
It's not a deal breaker.
No. How about betrayal of money? How about you took our money that we had saved for the kids to take them to college and you gambled it?
Well, when you have an addiction...
That's an addiction.
It's really a problem. Until that person... You can stand by a person who has problems. That's not what we're saying. When a person's sick, when there's troubles, you stand by a person. But if you watch a partner over and over and over again have an addiction, disrupt a family or your relationship, you almost can't solve it. That is actually more of a problem to me.
Then you take action. Then you must take action. Then you require, you go to AA, you do whatever you have to do to take action to solve the problem.
Sure.
Tragedy. Through the alchemy of desire, wants become needs. My choice that I have becomes my need. My unfulfilled needs becomes my personal tragedies. Oh, he doesn't love me enough. Oh, he wants to watch television instead of being with me. And it becomes tragic, and you tell your friends, and your friends commiserate. Oh, I have that same kind of tragedy. Yes, you have that tragedy. Yes, I have that tragedy. It's his friends. They influence him. And the tragedies become bigger and bigger. A husband who isn't expressive of his feelings can be a disappointment or a tragedy, depending on whether it's an entitlement. If the other person feels entitled, so what? If the man does not express his emotions, he doesn't express his emotions. You will learn to read his emotions and know what he feels. If it's so important to you, then why'd you choose him? You know? Maybe you don't want somebody who expresses their emotions. Maybe that's not such a great thing to have. People work their way into I'm a tragic figure around the ordinary problems of marriage. They're so widespread. And there's so many people who believe that they are just tragic. Tragic. And that's where Michelle Obama, came in and really did something good. She says, I was this tragic, tragic figure. And I realized that I was just being a tragic figure. What about Patty and Rod? You remember those Italian people?
That was a very interesting story that Hara wrote about. She described a couple that was on the verge of divorce. They lived in California, and they were married 18 years, and their life was just almost like this quintessential consumeristic life, where they had a wonderful house, they were involved with activities, they were always going, doing, all that type of life that they were living. And at one point, the husband had to take a business trip to Italy, and the wife was going to accompany him. And she said to herself, this is probably the last trip I'm ever going to take with him, and was going to contact a divorce lawyer. And she went to him. She went with him to Italy, and they went to this beautiful place in Genoa in Italy on the coast. And after the experience, they both enjoyed the place. After the vacation or the trip, the husband said, let's move here. Let's live here. So they literally took their two kids, moved to Italy, and lived in this town for a year. And they had to figure things out. They didn't speak the language. They simplified their life, and they relied on each other, and they learned about each other, and they got intimate, and they laughed, and they had discomfort, and they got rid of all that kind of American consumeristic culture out of their system. And they literally changed their lives, and they got back together, and they moved to Arizona, and they really reconnected and got away from this idea of so many choices and driving themselves to the point of separating. And so this was a really good example of what can happen from culture. The culture can inflict on us so many different ideas, and we don't even know who we are.
Patty Newbold. Patty Newbold had married a really great guy, but by the time their 13th anniversary rolled around, she had a long list of things he needed to change to make their marriage work. At 34, she felt depressed, frantic, and guilty, as Rod was fighting a chronic disease. Tough stuff when you have a partner fighting a chronic disease. But she had reached a breaking point. I read my husband my list of unmet needs and suggested a divorce, she said, even though what she really wanted was a marriage back. I wanted to feel loved again, but it didn't seem possible. Well, Patty Newbold had a long time to think about that list. Her husband died the next day, a freak side effect of his medication. He was gone, but the list remained. Out of the perhaps 30 needs, only one was eased by losing him. I was free now to move the drinking glasses next to the sink. As she read through the list the morning after he died, she realized that marriage isn't about my needs or his needs or about how well we communicate about our needs. It's about loving and being loved. Life is about meeting my needs and letting go of meeting my needs. That's part of my life. I make happen, not him. And then she was flooded with memories of all the times I'd been offered love by this wonderful man and rejected it because I was too wrapped in whatever need I was facing at the time. Revitalized is a funny word to describe a relationship in which one party is dead, she reports. But ours was revitalized. I was completely changed too. Everything she learned that day has gone into a second marriage, which is now into its second decade. And that's what we could say about everybody who's listening today. Everything you're hearing today can improve where you are and where you need to go. Running, challenging, threatening, that doesn't work. I met a young couple who have worked together, talked. They talked about issue after issue after issue. I'd say about 10% of which was really important, and 90% was just kind of getting to know each other indirectly. And then something went wrong, and they broke up. And I said to them, after knowing the kind of work they put in, I said, wait, before you go, would you come and see me once? I want to see if this is just going to be one of those casual throwaways that we do over and over again in this society. If you were together for a year, talking, meeting with each other, talking to each other, enjoying each other, even the little conflicts you have, do you dump it just in one angry fit?
I'm not sure how old they are, Armand, but something I do find...
34, 35.
Sometimes until you really get past that part where, you know, we talk about the chemistry of love. When you get past that part where all that blissful state where you're not angry, you're not fighting, you're having a great time, if you could get past the part that kind of starts to decrease and there are some arguments, you have to understand that that's going to be not the indication to leave once those blissful feelings are not as strong in you. That's not the time to leave. The next phase of getting to know each other and building activities together, whether it's having kids, owning a home, building interests together, that's when you get challenged. It's not the blissful time because that's the easy time. It's after that you have to understand. So if this couple was only together for a year, that tells me something. That they didn't get through that next phase. And that's often what I will tell people. You have to wait and see what happens in the next phase.
Well, one of the things that people do for each other, Stephanie, you know, is what is your job with me? A partner could support your dreams because they're involved. The traits and qualities of yourself that you want to develop. Whether or not you're articulating them clearly or simply express vague yearnings, people come to reflect what their partners see in them and elicit from them. Such affirmation promotes trust in the partner and strengthens commitment. So what do you want? I support you in this. Let me support your wants as best I can. You would like a healthier lifestyle? I will bring you healthier foods. Will I necessarily eat them myself? No. But I support your choices. I support what you want. I won't knock what you want. I'll keep in mind, in my mind, what you like. And I will support you all the way. You need to go running. You need to go walking a lot. And I don't walk as much as you do. I will support your use of your body, even if it means that you're not with me at the time. Support. And that's what we kind of do with each other. We support each other's dreams. If I have an ethic, if I have a belief, I want to help these people. You support my desire to help them. You could analyze it and tear it down because it doesn't fit you. You could say, ah, you're really trying to get over your guilt with your parakeet when you were a kid. You could interpret anything. And which is what people do. They make the other person's choices wrong because those choices are inconvenient, because they don't match my choices. But you could really work it out. So what you want to do is you want to create, it's kind of a commitment. There's a commitment to, I am committed to myself and my own well-being. I am committed to being and working here with you. What for? What for? I have seen people commit themselves to relationships that looked impossible. But in that commitment, what they would do is challenge themselves over and over again. You got to keep challenging yourself. You got to keep challenging the belief that you're entitled. Keep challenging the belief that the other person is going to provide your happiness or your pleasure. You have to challenge it. It is a willingness stemming in part from an understanding that your well-being and your partner's are linked over a long term. To depart from direct self-interest, such as erecting a grudge when you feel hurt. You know, get over those grudges.
I think I would like to add, though, Armand, that sometimes you're in a relationship, people can be in relationships where the other person doesn't want to work. And it's really destructive. So I would like to add that sometimes...
Well, tell me what you mean the other person doesn't want to work.
Well, work on the relationship, work on themselves, be kind of cooperative and understand it takes an enormous amount of effort to keep a relationship going. And so sometimes it is time to leave. You know, I don't want people to get the impression that we assume everyone should stay together and you're in a miserable situation, you're being treated very poorly or abused. That's not what we're talking about. It's when you have a partner and you have to understand that if you go to the next partner, if you bring yourself with you and you haven't worked out your issues, you're just going to have the same kind of situation over and over again. So if you have a willing partner, that's what I guess I mean, a willing partner to work, then that's where you can understand and make things happen. But if you just assume as soon as there's a problem with this person, it's got to be the person's faults and problems, and he leaves his sneakers at the, you know, at the bottom of the stairs, and I trip, and I'm disgusted with all these problems and character traits, you're going to just go and find another person, and it's going to be the same thing over and over again.
Well, that thing about repetition that happens to us is we please, we try to work it out, but, you know, I'm not so sure the partner has to change. Because what if the partner doesn't have to change?
Well,
what if the partner is perfectly happy and okay with himself?
Well,
and then the challenge becomes you have to change yourself.
Yes, I agree with that. You have to sometimes say, wait a minute, I want to talk to someone and my husband doesn't want to talk to me or my wife. We'll go find somebody else to talk to. It doesn't mean end a relationship.
Or find a way to talk to your husband that would be inviting for him.
Right. Okay. So there's all sorts of scenarios, but I just wanted to qualify that if it's a really bad situation...
Abusive is one thing.
Yes, right.
Abusive is one thing. Negligent could possibly be another. Addictions could be another.
Exactly.
These are the tough ones.
Mm-hmm.
But if she just wants to be who she is, and she likes to walk freely, and he says, I want you to be at home more often... But she needs to feel the beauty of her own walking through time and space. He's got to support it. He's got to support the other person's desire as best you can, unless the desire is destructive. Now, very often what people do is they interpret the other person's desire as a structure. You want to go walking because you want men to admire you. And then it brings up fears, because one of those things about letting the other person be who they are is you become at risk for them to be taken by some other chimpanzee. You know what I mean? You become at risk. If you're not holding on tight, if you're not crippling them, if you're not, you're taking a risk that that person may not want to be with you. But the most beautiful relationships I have ever seen are the people who support each other, are intent on being with each other, have a commitment, and they feel the desire for the other person to have their own happiness, even if you can't make it that way.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point, Armand. And I think, of course, one issue for many people is after the kids are born and then you have this whole experience of raising a family and sharing that life, something happens. Once those kids are gone and on their own and you're looking at your partner after many years and saying, what do we have here if we didn't have just this, you know, these kids? And it's a challenging time for people. If you don't have kids, if you don't have a house, and if you don't have projects, then what do people do to stay together? And it's really a critical thing. It's one piece, I think, that you have to have shared activities or accept that the other person has a lot of individual time away and you come back together and have something that bonds you. So shared activities, interests, you know, passions together usually keeps relationships going. Yeah, it seems to me when I see people that don't have kids or share a space, it's a unique challenge to figure out how to keep a relationship going.
Well, you know, if it's at the end, if you've done child rearing, Stephanie, and thank you for that, but if you've done bringing up kids, if you've done it right, when the kids leave, you're not lost in space because you're still connected.
Well,
if you've done it wrong, then you're probably just connected to the children, and the children have replaced everything in your life, and you've made the kids responsible for your happiness.
Yes.
And then the empty nest syndrome is that your happiness was dependent on the kids remaining eggs. Staying, you know, they have
like,
to...
Like little chicks.
Like they have to be like little chicks, and then when they leave, suddenly you have nothing in life. That's where your neglect of your relationship comes in.
And of yourself.
And of yourself, exactly right. Because we can't afford to neglect us. Anyway, like growth, commitment is an inside job. Commitment is an inside job. It's not a simple vow. You don't make a promise. Partners see each other in ways that enhance their connection and fend off threats. It forces the perception that the relationship you're in is better than that of others. It breeds the inclination to react constructively by accommodation rather than destructively when a partner does something that seems inconsiderate. It even motivates that the most difficult of tasks, forgiveness, for the ultimate harm, which is betrayal. Excuse me. It's a willingness, stemming in part from your understanding that your well-being and your partner's are linked over the long term. To depart from such self-interest, such as erecting a grudge when you feel hurt, gotta get away from that. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. We hope that you've enjoyed this. You can get copies of today's program by going to the website, wbai.org or thepositivemind.org. You could also find a copy of the article on which we based this program in Psychology Today. Is that this month's?
April 2010.
Special thanks to the author. What was her name?
Hara Astroff Marano.
We'll have her back on the air as well. So we will be back with you on soon, my friends. This was very nice, very pleasant, very positive, very strong. I am such an advocate of real love. No, I'm just going to go the 1 minute. Tony said only 1 minute because I'll talk to you about the details. Okay?
All right. Thank you very much. Armand DeMille with the Positive Mind.
Mambo, charanga, son montuno, jazz, merengue, plena, Latin jazz, Latin soul, Brazilian jazz, samba, calypso, soca, new sounds from the African continent, all this and more on New World Gallery every Sunday, 4 o'clock p.m. with award-winning host Chico Alvarez. New World Gallery, where jazz meets Latin, where Africa and Europe converge. Right here on listener-sponsored WBAI 99.5 FM.
TalkBack is your gathering place for the free and fair exchange of information and ideas heard here Monday through Thursday from 3 until 5 in the afternoon. I'm Hugh Hamilton. Join me as we explore the issues and events making news across the nation and around the world with expert guests, insightful analysis, and, of course, your comments, questions, and observations. That's TalkBack right here on WBAI New York.
Yo, this is G-Love on WBAI New York.
Jazz Vipers at WBAI, New York City.
WBAI would like to thank the following food donors for their generous donation during our winter fun drive. Veronica's Kitchen, 601 Williams Avenue in the Prospect Heights section of Brooklyn. La Gran Via Bakery, 4516 Fifth Avenue in the Sunset Park section of Brooklyn. Red Jacket Orchards, 957 Routes 5 and 20 in Geneva, New York. Please remember to thank these donors for supporting WBAI when you visit their establishments.
Cool. He's exciting.
This dude is bad.
He's sexy. Okay, maybe not. He's a bad mother.
Shut your mouth.
He's Tony Ryan on WBAI New York 99.5 FM. He's got both.
Break him with the sound of the trumpet.
Can you dig it?
Yeah, I can dig it, yeah.
He's got classic soul. He's okay, I can't think of anything else, but he's got a classic soul. Tune in on Sunday mornings, 2 a.m. to 5 a.m.
Soul Essential Station with Tony Ryan.
99.5 WBAI.
And we'll look forward to Soul Central Station with Tony Ryan right here over WBAI. That's where you're tuned to. We're at 99.5 on your F.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.